I am constantly amazed at the contrast between the state I live in and the state I work in when it comes to abortion laws. The state I live in is Illinois, where it seems, at least at this point in history, nearly impossible to even contemplate the passage of any kind of law that would regulate or restrict abortion in any shape, matter, or form. Missouri is better. There is a state, South Carolina, that apparently has some of the best regulation of the abortion industry, and we're going to talk a little bit about that in the first part of this first hour of Issues, Etc. In fact, a Supreme Court decision that is going to probably eventually have some impact in other states, hopefully maybe one day even in Illinois. We'll talk with Mary Spaulding Balsh in just a moment here about yesterday's Supreme Court ruling in support of a South Carolina law that allows health authorities to collect information on women seeking abortions. That's a long way from where we are here, but we'll talk about it as well. Then we'll be talking with Terry Mattingly over the bottom of the hour. He's a columnist for Scripps Howard News Service. He's a regular guest. There's a Roman Catholic priest, a prominent Jesuit who writes extensively, who has recently cut his ties with the Democratic Party. We will find out why from Terry. And then to round off the first hour of Issues, Etc., Dr. Christopher Wolf, he is from Marquette University. We'll talk to him about recent comments by Senator Rick Santorum on consensual sex, whether or not his comments were accurate or inaccurate, whether or not he got it right. We'll find out. And then we've got open lines for the second hour of the program. I want to keep focus on the issue of homosexuality. I've got two books to give away. One is Homosexuality and American Public Life. It's edited by one of the guests in the first hour, Christopher Wolf, and another edited by him called Same Sex Matters, The Challenge of Homosexuality. We'll be talking about that, but I will be turning the focus from homosexuality in public life to homosexuality in the church. Everybody and their dog is dealing with this. Every denomination and their denomination's dogs are dealing with this. We'll talk about that and other things during open lines. And then, in the last hour of the program, at long last, we will be having part three of our four-part weekly series on understanding the end times. Today, interpreting the favorite Bible passages of premillennial dispensationalists and see whether or not they say what dispensationalists say they say, whether they hold the water that they claim they do. Dr. Kim Riddlebarger joins us then in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Mary Spaulding Balsh is State Legislative Director for National Right to Life. She joins us now. Mary, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you.
Tell us about the law in South Carolina and the significance of the Supreme Court's decision regarding that law.
Well, the law is actually a modest regulation law that would regulate abortion facilities to bring them up to minimum standards that other freestanding facilities are currently required to meet. I noticed that you described it as one that collects information on women seeking abortions, but that really is a misunderstanding of what the law does. That's what our opponents would like us to believe the law says. It's the one that the issue that they tried to create for the United States Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court obviously wasn't accepting that description of the law.
Well, then clear it up for us, Mary. What precisely does this law permit state health agencies to do with regard to the information of women seeking abortions in South Carolina?
Well, what they do is they require that the abortion facilities maintain records and reports for a minimum number of years. I believe it's 10. They then, if there are accidents or certain types of fetal, reporting fetal deaths, things along those lines to the Department of Health, this is for statistical purposes, not for any invasion of privacy, as the argument to the Supreme Court was trying to make. It's basically to address if there are problems with women's health, the state would collect this information to address those problems.
Now, the Supreme Court, as I read the newspaper here in St. Louis, did not actually hear the case. They rejected the appeal without comment. What does that decision itself tell you about this law in South Carolina?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court recognizes that the Fourth Circuit, when it upheld the constitutionality of the South Carolina law, basically said that they're right, that states do have the right to pass these types of laws, that states have the rights to regulate freestanding clinics that perform surgical procedures.
In my many conversations on this subject with people all across the nation, by and large from the pro-life perspective, I must say, it has emerged for me at least as a picture nationally and state to state that we are woefully inadequate in regulating the abortion industry in the states and federally. Is this an accurate picture?
Well, I think that most Americans would be shocked to find out that the vast majority of abortion facilities are not regulated. South Carolina's law is the exception, not the rule. Most the abortion business and the abortion facilities in the states are not required to meet minimum standards. The most modest type of standards dealing with infection control, with fire emergency equipment, with something that people would assume is basic regulations, abortion facilities are not required to comply with even the minimum standards.
Why is this? If I go to the dentist's office, or if you go to a tattoo parlor, there are state laws in place that are in trying to ensure my health undergoing any procedure in any of those freestanding facilities. Why in the world not the abortion industry and their freestanding clinics?
Well, it's a good question. I would say that the Supreme Court has elevated abortion to a constitutional right. Obviously, I disagree with that, but they have created a situation where this is treated differently than medical procedures. It's been elevated to what the Supreme Court says is a constitutional right. I think that's obviously failing to recognize what goes on with an abortion, where with every abortion an unborn child dies. But that's what happens, is that the states have not regulated, and that abortion is done in an unfettered manner in the vast majority of states around the country.
Now, this maintaining of documents or maintaining of records by the abortion clinics, this is something they would maintain themselves. The state would not necessarily come in and say, give us all your records.
That's correct. When records would be revealed to the state is when there has been a complaint, and the particular records would be relevant to the investigation that would be ongoing.
So, in other words, we're really only asking the abortion provider to maintain the kind of records that any business offering a serious kind of, say, an auto mechanic, he's got to maintain some kind of records about what the work was done, things like that, in case there should be a problem in the future.
That's correct. This is bringing the abortion facilities in South Carolina up to the minimum standards that you would normally expect at a freestanding medical facility.
Now, the picture that the opponents and those who are decrying the Supreme Court's refusal to hear the appeal are saying, the picture they're painting is of state employees taking records from abortion clinics, photocopying them at will, and then, of course, they get tossed to the four winds and no one knows where people's private medical records go. How do you react to that?
Well, the law very clearly says that the information in these records must be maintained in a confidential manner. The investigators are professional. They know that if they do it in an incompetent, unprofessional way, they're going to lose their jobs. So I see that as a red herring. They haven't done that when they do investigations of other facilities. They're not going to do it with investigations of these facilities.
And yet, I read in the paper that the opponents, again, are saying that there is no provision in this South Carolina law that would make it a crime or even a misdemeanor for a state employee to disseminate this privately held information.
Well, I'm not aware of whether or not there's a specific law, but I do know there would be consequences to anybody that would reveal the name of any patient. I do know that the pro-life movement, the people that I know in the pro-life movement, are not looking for the names of the women who have made tragic decisions, and they're not. Why would they want to have this information? What they're trying to do is to help the women make a positive, life-giving decision, not one that is meant to harass the women in the crisis pregnancy.
Now, locally here, anywhere from 6 months to a year ago, I don't know when it was, there was a story locally with an abortion clinic where the abortion was botched, in a sense. The woman who was the victim of this was taken literally across the street in Granite City, Illinois, to a hospital,
mm-hmm.
where she was treated for, I think, excessive hemorrhaging. Somehow, her medical records did make it out and onto the internet. and they were, at least in part, in some sort of elitist fashion, published there. Is that an illegal activity?
I don't know. I think it's counterproductive for the pro-life movement, and I don't think it would be something that a true pro-lifer would want to do. The purpose of people in the pro-life movement, as I said a minute ago, is not to harass the women, but to help them make a life-giving decision. They're in crisis pregnancies. We want them to choose life. We don't want to harass them. It's not something that we see as being a productive thing to do.
And how would you respond to those who say, look, the issue here really is doctor-patient confidentiality, that the doctor has the duty to maintain the confidentiality of records and of things like this, and this would undermine his ability to do so?
Well, I would laugh, because I know that the way that the abortion business is set up, that the so-called doctor does not see his patient until he sees her lying on the table there ready for the abortion. He doesn't have a doctor-patient relationship with her. She's never seen him before until that moment. Many times she doesn't know his name. She has no contact with him before the abortion, and she has no contact with him after the abortion. So there's no doctor-patient privilege there. I think that the pro-life movement is not trying to find out who these women are, and they're not trying to harass these women. As for the abortion provider himself, I'm sure he's got an ad in the yellow paper. It's not that hard for anybody to find out who he is, and the pro-life people have not been interested in finding out who they are.
Mary, to end where I began this conversation, does the Supreme Court's refusal to hear the appeal on this South Carolina law represent at least a light at the end of the tunnel in states where there is so little, if zero, regulation, a potential for future state legislation in light of the Supreme Court ruling?
Well, I think what it says is that it recognizes the right of the state to regulate freestanding facilities. And I think that's the basic situation here. I think in terms of clinic regulations, you have to look at it as on a state-by-state basis.
Mary Spaulding-Balsh, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Well, thank you.
Mary Spaulding-Balsh is State Legislative Director for National Right to Life. If you'd like to visit them on the web, their website, of course, is nrlc.org, nrlc.org. You can also contact them via telephone at area code 202-626-8800. That's area code 202-626-8800. Through the bottom of the hour, we're going to turn our conversation to Senator Rick Santorum. He's been in the news a lot, and this story is not going away. We'll be talking with Terry Mattingly here in just a moment. He's a columnist for Scripps Howard News Service about Santorum's comments and about the reaction to it as well. Our phone numbers, I would remind you, are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In fact, that's not the subject with Mattingly. I'm getting ahead of myself with Terry. He is the guest. We will be talking to him about one priest. I just had my piles in the wrong order. A priest, Father John Kavanaugh, a rather prominent Jesuit who has written extensively, who is cutting ties with the Democratic Party. And we will find out why. And by the way, he's encouraging other Roman Catholics to do it as well. Terry Mattingly is Associate Professor of Media and Religion at Palm Beach Atlantic College in Florida. He's a columnist for Scripps Howard News Service and author of a recent column titled Cutting the Cord, a Jesuit Priest Says Goodbye to the Abortion Party. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
Terry, first of all, tell us who John Kavanaugh is.
Well, Kavanaugh is someone who probably has been known for at least a generation, if not longer, for writing a famous book called Following Christ in a Consumer Culture. That book has been read widely, and it's primarily viewed as kind of a statement of progressive Catholic views on issues of poverty, etc. He's the author of another book called Faces of Poverty, Faces of Christ. So he is a very much an old guard, kind of New Deal Democrat Catholic progressive. In other words, loyal to his church's teaching on social issues and very much pro-life, but someone who for a long period of time has openly, you know, identified with kind of the old coalition Democratic Party.
What changed his mind?
Well, he wrote a column about this which is where I saw it, and then I called him up and talked to him about it. He wrote a column in which he said that a crucial moment for him was the rejection of Judge Priscilla Owen for a U.S. Court of Appeals slot, where the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, all 10 Democrats on the committee, voted to bar her, even though she had received the highest recommendation and ranking from the American Bar Association, and she was then serving on the Texas Supreme Court. And the whole reason, it was very clear why she, the only reason that she was stopped from proceeding forward, which was her views on abortion rights. And Kavanaugh said he found himself sitting there reading about those hearings and watching those hearings on C-SPAN and elsewhere, and finally saying to himself, why am I still a registered Democrat? What is, you know, after watching this go on for a number of years, why haven't I cut that tie? And I really need to stress here that in the same article, he makes some arguments for why Catholic voters, devout Catholics, practicing Catholics, should also consider not registering in the Republican Party. And once again, this is the progressive, you know, social justice side of his personality and his views. He urged, in effect, Catholics to disengage from the Democratic Party and to register as independent voters and to, in effect, vote their conscience, but also try to signal to both parties that the Catholic vote was very much in play, you know, that it was no longer tied by loyalty to the Democratic Party.
Now, he says he's not a one-issue voter, even as a Democrat or an independent. What did then the rejection of Priscilla Owen, what did this tell him about the Democratic Party?
Well, his phrase for that was that I'm not a one-issue voter, but the Democratic Party has become a one-issue party. That, I mean, he would note, for example, that throughout the Clinton years, that Clinton violated his own political conscience, so to speak, on a wide range of issues and betrayed crucial Democratic constituency groups, such as labor, such as in one or two cases, one or two rare cases, even the gay and lesbian lobby. Clinton violated certain key Democratic constituency groups quite frequently, but he never violated that one. In other words, the one thing he would never veer from at all was abortion rights. And it's Kavanaugh's view that this has become the defining issue of this era of the Democratic Party.
Would he, and perhaps you didn't inquire this deep, but would he have characterized the Republican Party as equally a one-issue party on the other side of that same issue?
No, he would say, oh, definitely not. He would say that the Republican Party is clearly, at this point, not united on abortion at all. It's one of the reasons why he said that, you know, he sees no consistency of thought on the Republican side of the fence at all. And but you could make a very strong case right now that the Democratic Party has a litmus test on abortion, but that the Republican Party doesn't. And that at this point, clearly, I mean, there are appointments all across the spectrum on that issue in the modern Republican Party. Quite a bit of diversity, so much so that someone like a James Dobson, you know, would probably be very upset about some of what he sees happening politically in the modern Republican Party.
Let's focus on the Roman Catholic voter, if we could. Tell us about Catholic voting habits of history and of late.
Well, of course, up through the FDR era and pretty much all the way into the 60s, you had the Catholic urban labor vote, especially in the Rust Belt and into the Northeast, the Atlantic Seaboard, was an absolutely critical part of the Democratic constituency. It was something that they could count on, you know, just like, you know, rain in South Florida during the summer at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was just something that was always going to be there. But this started changing gradually during the 70s and 80s, especially Catholic voters were a strong part of what became known as the Reagan Democrats, if you remember that. A symbolic moment for many people in this occurred in 1992. In fact, the column I'm working on for this week will make reference to this. In 1992, when the very strongly Catholic Democrat Robert Casey, the governor of Pennsylvania, the Democratic Convention was held in Philadelphia, and Casey was banned from addressing the convention in his own capital because he was pro-life, and they were afraid that he would say something against the platform of the Democratic Party on that issue. And so Casey was a very strong Democrat. His campaign manager for his previous election, when he came from way behind, his campaign manager was James Carville, for example. He was a Democrat's Democrat, but he went off the range, so to speak, on that issue. And that was, for many people, a highly symbolic moment, you know, for the modern Democratic Party.
And what has changed since? You note in your column that that nearly three-fifths of Catholics who said they went to Mass frequently voted for George W. Bush in 2000.
Well, it's clear that the modern Republican Party has noted this statistic. This has become what some people refer to as the Pew Gap, which is that the more likely it is that a person goes to church, the more likely it is that they will vote Republican. And and the inverse, by the way, is just as true. People, the less someone goes to church, the more likely they are to vote Democrat. And that this has emerged as the most underwritten story in American politics.
Now, while we're talking about the Catholic voter, there are trends also in that can be tracked of flips in the evangelical voter, aren't there as well?
Well, I mean, everyone's been following that, but once again, the same trend holds. The more you go to church, the more likely it seems to be that you vote Republican. But no, you know, while the evangelical story continues to get so much coverage and so much press, the reality is there haven't been any terribly sharp changes there. The story is elsewhere. And I can't tell you how important the issue of Catholic voters are in an era of, you know, astonishing growth of Hispanic political power in the three states that are the future of American politics, California, Texas, and Florida.
Let's talk about that when we come back, Terry. That's interesting to me because, of course, a lot has been made in the press of President George W. Bush and the Republican Party collectively seeking the Hispanic vote, and I'm wondering there whether or not he's actually going for a twofer, not only the Hispanic vote from the kind of cultural standpoint, the language standpoint, but also from its association with the Roman Catholic Church. Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Media and Religion at Palm Beach Atlantic College in Florida. He's columnist for the Scripps Howard News Service and author of a recent column titled Cutting the Cord, A Jesuit Priest Says Goodbye to the Abortion Party. We're talking, of course, about and expanding from here, talking about Father John F. Kavanaugh, who said goodbye to the Democratic Party very recently. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Children love stories, especially stories that are true. The greatest story you can tell your children is found in the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April called The Very First Easter. In this book, Dr. Paul Meyer vividly retells the story of Jesus' betrayal, his passion, his trials, his crucifixion, and his resurrection. It's the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Very First Easter. You can order this book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on The Very First Easter. You can also order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on the Tobo tribe who live in the South Pacific country of Papua New Guinea. They want missionaries to teach them about God. Missionaries Jason Knapp and Chad Mankins with New Tribes Mission were welcomed into a Tobo village. The leaders asked them to provide missionaries so the people can learn about God. The villagers happily gave Knapp and Mankins bananas, tomatoes, passion fruit, onions, and cucumbers, all grown in local gardens. The Tobo leaders wanted to hear God's word in their own language, so they asked Knapp and Mankins to send more missionaries. There are 5 million people in Papua New Guinea. Official numbers state that up to 97% of the people are Christians. However, there are still tribes like the Tobo where people don't know about Jesus Christ. Pray for the Tobo. Here's a unique way to let other people know you're praying. Log on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org and visit the Encouragement Center to note your prayer activity and encourage others. Visit missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Smallpox, tuberculosis, polio. Medical science defeated them. We got the idea then, if we could only cure cancer and heart disease and a few others, we'd arrive at continual health. But then came sicknesses, some totally new, others new to us. Legionnaire's disease, AIDS, West Nile virus, and now SARS. Does it shake your faith in our progress toward perfection? Despite such setbacks, some people assume that nature is perfect, corrupted only by man and our modern lifestyle. We may well be sinners, but oh, not Mother Nature. Yes, eventually we will get back into harmony with perfect Mother Nature. The first book of the Bible takes a contrary view. When Adam and Eve brought sin into the world and made it part of our inheritance, nature was also corrupted. Genesis 3 calls the ground cursed and says it will produce troublesome thorns and thistles. Of course, some problems in nature are man-made, but tornadoes, hurricanes, and earthquakes aren't. SARS, like thorns and thistles, reminds us nature isn't perfect. God, give us the wisdom to rein nature in without ruining our lives and environment.
And Jesus comes and he points out, oh, so you want to be right in God's eyes by what you do? Well, then you got to get rid of all your sin. You not only cannot murder somebody by some action, first degree murder, but you can't even think about it. Because the same punishment is given to the one who says fool as to the one who puts a dagger in the heart. All sins, therefore, necessitate the death of Jesus Christ on the cross.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a prominent Roman Catholic priest who has recently cut his ties with the Democratic Party and why and what he's recommending the Catholics do nationwide. Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Media and Religion at Palm Beach Atlantic College in Florida and columnist for Scripps Howard News Service. He's written an article in a recent edition of Touchstone Magazine. It is called Cutting the Cord, A Jesuit Priest Says Goodbye to the Abortion Party, and you can read this column for yourself and other columns by our guest Terry Mattingly at his website tmatt.net. That's tmatt.net. Terry, is President George W. Bush and the Republican Party attempting something of a twofer by going both for the Hispanic vote and hoping also to pick up a pretty significant portion of the Catholic vote as well?
Well, see, obviously, but of course the Hispanic vote is now more complex than that in the sense that for a generation or so, you've had quite high conversion rates, you know, into some parts of evangelicalism, I guess especially the Assemblies of God and to a lesser extent the Southern Baptist Convention among Hispanics. So I wouldn't make it, you know, like a direct cause and effect. In other words, you get the Hispanics, you get Catholics, you get the Hispanics. It's more complex than that, but there's no question that a lot of people are thinking this way. Have you been following the story about whether or not Tom Daschle?
I was just going to ask you about that.
Has been told to stop identifying himself as a Catholic politician. Rome has made it more clear in the recent past that it wants to try to be more specific on these kinds of issues. Now you could make a strong question, raise a strong question, as I'm sure Father Kavanaugh would. Would Rome make the same objection on Republicans who are Catholics, who have, in the eyes of many in the church, not voted consistently enough on issues of peace and justice.
Well, that raises a question. I want to come right back to that after this. What if not the Democratic Party, according to Father Kavanaugh, why not the Republican Party? What specifically keeps him in the independent camp rather than switching camps altogether, the other, well, the so-called other end of the poll?
It's absolutely crucial that your listeners not think that Father Kavanaugh has called for an entry into the Republican Party. That would be totally against the spirit of what he said. And he cites a host of different issues. One of the primary ones is he believes that the Republican Party, almost as much as the Democratic Party, is engaging in what he would simply refer to as moral libertarianism. That the Republican Party, on many cultural issues, is changing their, you know, to follow the path of the Democratic Party, only more slowly. He would also say on issues of treatment of the poor, on some issues of education, he would cite a whole host of traditionally progressive issues related to the Catholic Church's clear collision with the Republican Party on issues of health care. He would have a long list.
So what would be called the whole panoply of social moral issues in the public square, excluding abortion here, also concern him deeply about the Republican Party? Is that concern apparently shared by rank and file Catholics?
I don't know how anyone could say that. It is safe to say that based on the polling that I've seen, and the work of certain social scientists such as John DiIulio, the Democrat in Philadelphia, who briefly mm-hmm. was the head of the faith-based initiative for George W. Bush, a lot of people would simply say that Catholics are not as conservative on economic issues and issues of using the government to address social problems. Catholics are not as conservative and libertarian on those issues as Republicans.
So what does the recent action in South Dakota by the bishop who oversees the diocese of which Tom Daschle is a member, what does this kind of pressure or this kind of, I think it was intended to be private, but it's become public rhetoric about don't call yourself a Catholic because you're pro-choice. What does that tell you about the direction of the Roman Catholic Church and its relationship vis-a-vis very prominent Roman Catholic politicians
yeah.
who are off the reservation on the issue of abortion?
Let me be very candid here. This tells us much more about clashes within the Roman Catholic hierarchy here in America than it tells us about the future and the health of Democratic politicians.
What do you mean by that?
It tells us that there are bishops in the Catholic Church who strikingly disagree with each other on whether or not they will lift a finger to enforce or even promote their church's moral teachings. Now, I think that this is much more about a division among Catholic bishops than it is about a division involving Catholic politicians.
Terry Mattingly, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc. I appreciate your time and your columns as well.
Well, thank you.
Terry Mattingly is Associate Professor of Media and Religion at Palm Beach Atlantic College in Florida. He, of course, is columnist for Scripps Howard News Service, and he has written a recent column. It appeared in Touchstone Magazine and also on his website. It is called Cutting the Cord, a Jesuit Priest Says Goodbye to the Abortion Party. You can read on his website all of his columns. His website is tmatt.net. That's TMATT.net. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Christopher Wolf from Marquette University. The subject, were the recent comments made by Senator Rick Santorum on consensual sex within the home inaccurate, and what has been the fallout, and why isn't this story going away? Dr. Christopher Wolf is professor of political science at Marquette University in Milwaukee, president of the American Public Philosophy Institute, and editor of the books Same-Sex Matters and Homosexuality in American Public Life. Dr. Wolf, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's great to be with you.
What exactly did Senator Santorum say, and were these comments as reported accurate?
In some of the cases, they actually substituted the word gay for one of the words he used, but generally it's accurate. But they, on the other hand, they've been usually misinterpreted. What he said was this: there's an anti-sodomy law in Texas that's being considered by the Supreme Court right now, and some people are saying that it should be struck down. And one of the principles that's sometimes offered for striking down that law is that consensual sex in the home should be protected. You know, that shouldn't be regulated at all. And what Santorum said was, if you accept the principle of consensual sex within the home, that means not just homosexuality, it also means things like, you know, bigamy, polygamy, incest, adultery, that is, other kinds of consensual sex within the home that, frankly, the American people think should be prohibited. And he said, likewise, you know, this the sodomy law should be upheld. He said very strongly that he disagrees with the privacy decision whereby the Supreme Court read a right to privacy into the Constitution.
Was he attempting to draw a direct parallel, as he has been accused of doing, between homosexuality, consensual homosexuality within a private residence, and things that are recognized to be crimes by most everyone, namely incest and other forms of sexual crimes?
Well, he was trying to draw a parallel, at least in this respect, that what they have in common is that they're consensual sex in the home that is prohibited and should be prohibited. Obviously, when you put things into a category, it doesn't mean that everything in the category is identical. You know, so for example, you know, homosexuality is not like all kinds of incest. Whereas in some respects, though, if you have especially a consensual, you know, incestuous relationship in a home, what if a 40-year-old father and his 20-year-old daughter want to have consensual sex in their home in a home? I mean, well, in some respects, there is something similar between that and homosexual activity, which is, well, most Americans think this kind of sex is beyond the legitimate boundaries of what should be permitted. Obviously, there are differences, you know. Incest involves parents. Homosexuality doesn't. But those differences shouldn't ignore the fact or hide the fact that there's some key element that they do have in common, which is, that I think in our society, that the principle that Santorum wants to push is that we're dealing with sex that has nothing to do with marriage and family. And that's what sex is about. And since the family is so essential to the well-being of society, it's something that we ought to try to defend and promote.
Isn't that really the larger debate, Dr. Wolf, and that is the definition of the family, the definition of what marriage ought to be?
Absolutely. It's absolutely key. And frankly, one of the reasons why there's been a lot of slippage on the homosexuality issue is because there's been a lot of slippage on heterosexual morality. You know, we shouldn't be surprised to see homosexuality becoming a big public issue when you see the changes that have occurred in heterosexual morality since the 1960s. You know, one time, you know, states had fornication laws in the book. It was kind of widely accepted that that was appropriate. It doesn't necessarily mean you go, you know, breaking into people's rooms to see if they're having, you know, they're fornicating. But, I mean, that the law at least embraced the principle that this is not appropriate, that sex is for marriage. Well, since the 1960s, that's been blown away. You know, I wonder if you actually took an average, you know, 21-year-old and actually traced, you know, what are the instances of sex that they've seen in their life as they watch the media and read books and things of that sort, and exactly how many of those instances of sex had anything to do with marriage or especially with children. You know, the fact of the matter is that our society is awash in sex that's completely unrelated to marriage and children, and so we shouldn't be surprised, perhaps, that the family has been weakened rather dramatically in the last few decades.
Describe some particulars of homosexuality as a matter of public concern.
Well, the key thing is that if you embrace homosexual activity as legitimate, and even more so if you embrace gay marriage, what you're doing is you're legitimizing or giving, you know, kind of public approval of a kind of sexuality that is intrinsically unrelated to family, to children. The key to marriage and the reason why it's a matter of public concern is that it's really the way that society survives over time, the way that, you know, we pass on our society and what we've done to the next generation. And so marriage is a key social institution as well as a personal relationship. Well, homosexual activity is something that, by its very nature, really can't be, you know, something that deals with family or children. It's intrinsically a relationship that is sterile. And, you know, traditionally, you know, society has denied the name of marriage to that kind of activity. And I think that's the most important thing. I mean, there are clearly other things as well, and that has to do with the complementarity of the sexes, which is important to marriage. And many of us feel that homosexuals are, I mean, we don't look at them as, you know, as criminals or people, you know, that we want to punish. We actually think of it more as people who really have a very unfortunate psychological affliction, and we want to help people, first of all, by preventing them from sliding into that condition, and then secondly, by trying to persuade those people who are in the condition to make the fairly strenuous efforts that are necessary to try to get themselves out of it, if possible.
You said that homosexuality is intrinsically unrelated to family and children. You explained rather well what it is you mean by that, the sterility, the natural sterility of the relationship, but the advocate for gay marriage, same-sex unions might say, look, the real answer to that is to legalize adoption for gay couples.
Well, that's still a kind of mimicking of family rather than being a natural family. The key to marriage, what really is distinctive about marriage, about the marital act, in fact, is the fact that this is the mechanism, the way by which human beings come into existence. They come into existence through this unity of a man and a woman in love and marriage, ideally. And that's what society should have hold up as the ideal. It's also true that these days you can make kids in a test tube in a lab, and that's, frankly, I think that's very unfortunate as well, that we move away from the natural foundation for marriage and for children, and move in ways that are really subject to simply human will, human choice, or in some cases just human technology. But I think that movement has coincided with other changes in society that are not unrelated to them. That is, I think the changing understanding of sex has coincided with the declining stability of the family, and I think there's a connection between those two. You know, the changes in ideas of sexuality in the 1960s especially, which detached sex from marriage and family and children, I think are very closely or very integral to the set of changes that has led to increasingly unstable marriage and a society in which a huge number of kids don't get raised throughout their childhood with a mother and a father.
How would you rate the, on a scale, the legitimization of homosexual activity in our culture? Has it progressed beyond the point of no return?
Well, it's hard to say. You only know it's beyond the point of no return when you don't return. So if you want to fight it, you got to fight it and see what's up. Right now, the problem is that the organs of public opinion, the media, the entertainment industry, are just overwhelmingly on the side of a kind of gay liberation. And the result is that they can make a lot of noise, and they can portray the matter as if it were a done deal. The fact of the matter is, though, that if you look at polls, opinion polls, Americans generally still oppose gay marriage. And when you think of the propaganda to which they've been subjected for the last, you know, 20 years at least, it's really striking, I think, that public opinion has still resisted on that issue. And it suggests that maybe the issue is not as closed as some people think it is.
What of the distinction, in an attempt to clarify his comments, Senator Santorum later in the news cycle said, look, I have nothing against, I paraphrase, of course, I have nothing against homosexuals, but I do have something against homosexual acts. What is this distinction that he's attempting to make?
Well, I think he's right on the money there. One thing that we have to understand is that, you know, often people ask, is homosexuality a choice, or is it something that's kind of hardwired in the biology or in the genes? And the answer is that's a false dichotomy, because they're both wrong. Homosexuality is not a choice. Most homosexuals don't sit down and say, well, gee, I'd like to be a homosexual. Most, you know, at some point in their early lives experience themselves having same-sex attractions that they haven't asked for or gone about, you know, deliberately choosing. On the other hand, it's not just hardwired or genetic either. There's pretty solid scientific evidence about the limits of any conceivable genetic contribution. For example, if you have identical twins who have the exact same genes and one of them is homosexual, the other, theoretically, if it were genetic, should be homosexual 100% of the time. Well, it's actually only about 50% of the time. And even that, it's hard to know how much that's genetic because typically these identical twins have been raised in the same environment, the same family. So the fact of the matter is that homosexuality is a condition that's not chosen, but it's not hardwired either. It's something that's probably the fruit or the result of early childhood experiences, things that can be reversed, although they're very difficult to do that. And because it's not a matter of choice, the actual attractions themselves shouldn't be, you know, an object of contempt or moral disapproval. Just because somebody has these attractions, I don't say they're bad people. But the attractions themselves are clearly disordered. And so that's the distinction that Santorum makes. You know, you love homosexuals like you love everybody else, but you don't say that their acts are good because these acts, in fact, are disordered.
What about the comparison that has been made by some in criticizing Santorum between his comments and the comments of Senator Trent Lott that had racial overtones?
Well, you know, this is just an example of people trying to twist something for political purposes. I mean, race is irrelevant, you know, to any kind of legitimate public policy concerns. You know, the color of somebody's skin doesn't determine anything about them, whereas homosexual acts have a real bearing on our understanding of sexuality, on our understanding of marriage, which is the foundation for society. And so there's just a profound difference between race and color on one hand and homosexuality, and especially homosexual acts on the other hand.
And I'm wondering about, this is something I've been wondering about since the Santorum story broke, and that is the whole emphasis seems to be how could the senator possibly question anything we do in the home, and yet the gay activists, by and large, seek to take the issue of homosexuality out of the home and into the public square.
Well, you know, we shouldn't be surprised by this, I don't think. You know, if you imagine the case of a homosexual in American society today, they feel that this part of them is something that's very natural and unchangeable and therefore completely legitimate. And what they want from society is not just toleration. I mean, they want affirmation from society as well. They want to be told you're not some kind of abnormal person, some kind of abnormal human being. You have your own way of doing things, and that's just as good as anybody else's way of doing things as long as you don't harm anybody. And, you know, I think that's wrong, but at the same time, gosh, I mean, what would you expect them to do? I mean, that they want to achieve that legitimization for the way they live. And it's just a question of trying to explain to people as much as possible to get them to understand why it is that society rejects that understanding of sexuality. It's a tough, tall order. It's not an easy thing to do.
And what specifically can be done to make progress on this issue?
Well, to tell you the truth, I mean, I've edited a couple of books on homosexuality, which were based on a conference I did in Washington in 1997. And the purpose of the conference was partly to put out a persuasive case which might change some people's minds. But frankly, even more, I think, the purpose of the conference was to educate our own people, the people on our side of the debate, to really understand the issue better so that they're capable of making an articulate case on this issue in public. And frankly, I think there's been a lot of weakness there, that a lot of people haven't been very articulate. I mean, Santorum is one of the very few brave politicians who's been willing to stand up and make, you know, articulate arguments on this subject. And you see what the result is. I mean, he becomes the object of an enormous public vituperation, a mischaracterization of his remarks in the media all over the place. And so what we have to do is we have to educate our own side, and that's one reason why those books are out there, you know, to try to educate people so that they can understand the issue better and talk about it more intelligently.
He has been accused of advocating the criminalization of homosexual behavior. How do you assess that critique?
Well, in one sense it's true, but in another sense it's not. He's upholding, he's defending a Texas anti-sodomy law that's a criminal law. That is, it's a law that whereby society goes on record as saying this kind of activity is wrong, this kind of activity should not be engaged in. In principle, it's punishable activity. And on the other hand, you know, very few people that I know of, you know, want to set up some kind of squads to go around busting down bedroom doors to find out what people are doing and punish them if they're doing something wrong. Even in this case, the Texas case, like the first homosexual sodomy case at the Supreme Court that was decided in 1986, this case actually rose accidentally. It was when the police had information about something else, and they went into somebody's living quarters and accidentally discover them having homosexual sex. In cases like that, frankly, you know, probably the best thing to do, you know, most of the time, I think, is for the police just to kind of sheepishly leave and go away. You know, I would save criminal enforcement of sodomy law for pretty blatant kinds of disregard for the law, you know, where somebody, you know, publishes on, you know, the front page of the newspaper, we're living together and, you know, that's because this law is something we despise or something like that. Our concern is not, you know, with the law, it's not primarily to go around enforcing it against people. The key is that society itself takes a stand and educates the people, the citizens of the society, on what sex is all about. It's also valuable in other ways, too, indirectly.
We've got about 30 seconds here,
right.
Dr. Wolf.
In education, what do? You know, do you treat heterosexuality and homosexuality equally in high school sex education programs? Well, actually, having anti-sodomy laws on the books is very useful because it gives a ground for why it is that we can say heterosexuality is normative and homosexuality is not. So let me just suggest that if people have the chance to try to get a hold of homosexuality in American public life and same-sex matters, if they mention that they heard about it on your show, they can get a 40% discount.
And we will be talking about that. I'm actually going to give a couple copies away. Dr. Christopher Wolf, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Dr. Christopher Wolf is professor of political science at Marquette University in Milwaukee, president of the American Public Philosophy Institute, and author of those two books, Same Sex Matters and Homosexuality in American Public Life. Open Lines is next. I'll tell you about how you can get the books, and I'll give a couple of them away during Open Lines.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.